is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about, well, it's just not a will. It's really the importance of estate planning for women. Now, you might find that strange that I would introduce it, but I've been invited to be the guest male to learn the importance of the estate planning for women. And to lead us in that discussion is Ann Sullivan, attorney, associate in the law firm Handler & Levine, fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you.
Great. Good to have you. And good friend, co-host Tammy Flanagan, senior benefit director, NITP, weekly GovExec columnist. And not only on the net, now you're in the print, right?
Well, for the they had some extra space in the magazine this month, so I was lucky enough to get that spot. So thank you, Bob. Good morning.
You're being too modest. Good morning. And Dorothy, the ever-efficient engineer, will guide us through. So, Ann, it's not just a will. Well, what is it? What is estate planning? I mean, and then we'll get into why it's so important for women.
Well, we always say this in the seminars, but it's true. You know, I think that when I talk to friends and at the seminars, most people think, you know, if I, as my partner Norman likes to say, if I get hit by a car, I better have a will. But really, there are three documents that everybody needs as part of their estate plan, whether you're 18 years old or you're 70, and that's a will and a power of attorney and a health care directive. And the power of attorney and the health care directive, that allows you to point somebody that you trust to make financial or medical decisions for you if you don't have the capacity to do so.
Okay. Now, why is it so important for females to be aware of this?
Well, when you first asked me, I think it was about a year and a half ago, actually, about doing this show, I went back and I thought, you know, I don't know that they're both men and women need them, so I don't know that there's a separate discussion. But then when I started thinking about it and saw it in my practice and looked into it, I realized that estate planning really is a woman's issue because women actually, at age 55, about one in three women become widows. That's compared to 9% of men.
By the age of 55?
Yes.
Wow.
And
that's kind of a startling statistic.
It is. And 700,000 women will become widowed this year. It's because, you know, they marry older spouses and women live longer than men. But it's a surprising statistic. And what that means is another thing that's important, what I see is that women, because they have children or for one reason or another, tend to see gaps in their careers where they might not work or they work part-time or even if both are professionals. Women tend to make a little bit less than men still. And what I find is, you know, women need to be careful. They need to make sure that they have enough if their spouse dies. And they often have the last word when it comes to how much wealth goes to the family, charity, or to taxes. So it really is a woman's issue.
Okay. And what should they, let's say they haven't thought about it and they're under 55 and there could mm-hmm. be this situation that arises. What should they look at? First, second, third. I mean, what would be the primary focus that they would need to be anxious about?
Well,
I guess there's also, before you get into that answer, if you're a married woman who does have a spouse, I would think this is something you would do jointly with your spouse. But if you're a single woman, it's going to be a different issue. So maybe like separate it out, maybe starting with single women.
That's right. If you're, it's always good to do it with your spouse if you're married. If you're a single woman and this is particularly true if you have children. I like to also break this up for when you're younger and maybe sort of mid-career and older. But if you're younger and if you're married or you're single, the biggest concern that you're going to have if you have children are who are going to look after my children. And if I have money, say in my TSP or my retirement accounts or with Fegley, with life insurance, how do I want that money to go to my kids? You know, think about all of that money. We think about what we have as the pennies in our pocket, but you have to think what would go to other people and picture all of that money at once, you know, going to a minor child or even a child under age 30. So that applies to a lot of people, either young people or people in their mid-career. I think single women, if they have children, have an added, you know, concern of, all right, really, I need to figure out who's going to watch my children, depending if they're a widow or if they have an ex-husband.
Now, if you have that conversation with your sister and saying, oh, Julie, I want you to be the person that takes care of my children, is that enough, or does something have to be in writing, or is it just a statement?
That's an interesting question. I think that people think they can have these casual conversations with people.
I know.
Like, hey, to your sister or something, yeah, do you help take care of my kids? And they'll say, sure, and that's fine. It needs to be in writing. Listen, what happens is that, you know, the default is that, say I'm in a car accident and something happens to me and I die, my husband would be the one that could look after our kids. But if we're both in an accident and we both die, at that point, you know, the courts are going to decide who's going to take care of my kids. It doesn't matter that you got your sister Julia to say, sure, I will. Things can happen, you know. We've seen, and unfortunately we haven't seen this very often, but, you know, custody disputes can arise over who's going to take care of your child. And then what's worse, and it's terrible to think about, is sometimes nobody
steps up,
sets up to the plate. Mm-hmm. And your child could be put into foster care or orphan. It's really something that you need to think about in advance and get it in writing, because that's right. People think they can sort of informally do that.
Right. Now, if I have that in a off the internet type will that I've just printed out and I put Julie in there, is that going to be enough to satisfy the court?
Well, that's a whole separate discussion about what I think of LegalZoom. And yes. I mean, if you follow the conformity of a will, what's in a will, and I can talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. Be effective. It's an important document, and really,
do you really want it to be something you've just downloaded for free?
Exactly. This involves your children. Yeah. So is it really something that you kind of get what you pay for? So, and you want to just make sure, in a will, by the way, you know, promises, videotapes, those types of things, it doesn't count. It has to be in writing and, signed and dated, and you need two witnesses. Now, I know that people listen all across the country to this show, but just to give you an idea, and different states work this way, but for the most part, just remember this with witnesses. Virginia, D.C., they have to be disinterested witnesses. This is a good idea for Maryland, too, but just or any other state. You don't want to have the people that are inheriting your property be your witnesses, and they should be over 18 and U.S. citizens. So, you know, those are just sort of the basics of what's in a will. But again, I'd be leery or just careful about what you see over, mm-hmm. you know, the internet.
You can't videotape. My heart is broken. Brewster's Millions is an old movie with Richard Pryor, and the will was on the videotape, and he had to go out and spend it. I'm shattered. All righty. So if we're looking at that, if I could just, what if we get somebody that isn't married but has a domestic partner?
Yeah.
And maybe there's an adopted child, or maybe there's a child from. That's got to be a really tough maneuvering. And all states, I don't think, recognize domestic partnerships.
That's correct. Some states are, you know, D.C. is, you know, they do. There was a registry, and also, you know, obviously the laws have recently changed where you can get married in D.C., and Maryland has recently said they'd accept that. But certain states do not. Virginia, for example, is a state that does not recognize it. There are many states that don't. You have to be careful and be proactive if you have a domestic partner, to make sure, particularly if you have an adopted child, to make sure to get that in writing and in a will about who you want to have take care of the child and who you want to have manage assets that might be in trust for your child. As well as, even if you don't have a child, if you have a domestic partner, you really need to be active about getting a will in place to make sure that, you know, those assets are going to them and you've protected them.
Are there other pieces of paper, if you will, with directives, like I think of healthcare directive?
Sure.
I mean, when a will is done, should it be part of several other things?
Yes. Yes.
Sorry for the lack of legalese, but other things?
No. Yes, and that's back to the documents we were talking about. By the way, I get this sometimes in the seminar where people say, can I have my healthcare directive and my power of attorney and my will? No, we don't do it that way. Really, keep them. They're three separate documents. And
some of them are for while you're still alive,
exactly.
And other ones are for after you're
yes,
not here.
Yes, it's surprising. Sometimes I go through it. But, you know, I think people are thinking, I would just like to make this simple. Just put it in one thing.
Put it all in one place.
No, you have your will, and that's for after you die. But the power of attorney and the health care directive is while you're alive. And I just want to say about the health care directive, there's a statutory form now in all 51 jurisdictions. They're called different things in different states, but it does two things. And a lot of people are familiar, like, oh, I have a living will. Attorneys, we don't use that term anymore. Don't be afraid if you're out there and like, oh, geez, I got this 8-year-old living will. You don't have to go tonight and change it, but you really should think of changing it to the statutory form. That's what doctors are comfortable with. The first part of the form, you appoint an agent. This is somebody, a person that you trust to make healthcare decisions for you if you can't express your wishes to a doctor, or they might make end-of-care decisions for you based on what you want in the second part of the form. The second part of the form talks about all those things that none of us really like to think about, but, you know, end-of-life decisions.
What would I want?
If I'm in a persistent vegetative state, do I want all medical measures to be kept alive, or at that point, you know, pull the plug, those types of things.
Okay. That's called a health care directive.
That's a health care directive, mm-hmm. And that's different from a power of attorney. A power of attorney is for your money, your finances, for those types of things. That's appointing somebody that you want to maybe pay your bills, or, you know, also give to charities or make changes to your estate plan. It's very broad. You can make it limited too, but really what we're talking about in estate planning is you've got to think about what will happen to me if I were, say, become incapacitated for a long period of time. We don't like to think about it, but this also gets to when I talk about young people, middle-aged, you know, mid-career, older. Everyone should think about this, like I said, but I am finding that in my practice, people are living a lot longer. That's great. But more people are coming in with, you know, that were clients from four, and they're coming in and they've been diagnosed with beginning stages Alzheimer's or dementia. We're seeing that more and more. So you really think these people could live for 10, 15, 20 years. So you want to think, what do I normally do? What do I want to have happen? You know, what do I want somebody to be able to do for me if I can't?
Let's say that you have a relative that's been diagnosed with dementia and they're kind of in the beginning stages. Mm-hmm. Is it too late for that person to sign a living will or power of attorney or health care directive, I should say?
I'm going to say no, but it really depends. Mm-hmm. And an attorney and maybe a doctor sometimes is going to have to evaluate that. But I would like to say as a backup, yes, if you can, get to the table before you get to the point, to that point. And I'll explain why in a minute. But you don't have to have a high level of capacity to sign a power of attorney or health care directive. It's actually a pretty low level. You have to understand the nature, basically the nature of finances, or to be able to just generally understand what the documents are about.
So the lawyer could evaluate that when the family comes to the table.
In fact, sometimes people are better at certain parts of the day or times than other times. And if you get them during a time when they're lucid. They're really, you know, and they can talk about, they understand exactly what they want and have a good memory at that point, it's fine.
So I guess the bottom line is to feel like it's not too late. So if you do have a family member, that you should check into that.
Go right away. And that's what I have seen lately. The reason I say, obviously, it's much better to do this in advance is because you don't want questions popping up with if there's a family situation where siblings or children or something, somebody could come in and try, you know, argue that, hey, this person didn't have capacity. Because even if the court finds that they do, you don't want to create,
any
you don't
reason
have to go
for
to court.
There to be a challenge.
Right. You don't want there to be a reason for a challenge. Another thing I found with clients who have sort of beginning stage dementia or Alzheimer's, and this goes also for people who are just ill sometimes in general, they tend to be a little bit skeptical of what people's intents are at that point. They go through periods where, like, yes, I want this done. Mm-hmm. And then they come back and they say, well, why, you know, why does my son want to do this? Why does he want to take over my bills? Sometimes the person that's starting to get incapacitated, they don't think they are, and they want you out of their business.
Right. So, it can be difficult.
Right.
At any age, really, because sometimes you just feel like, I don't want to hand that power over to somebody.
Oh, absolutely.
That I might change my mind about later on.
Well, you raise a good point. You know, there's two ways a power of attorney, by the way, and this is a healthcare directive too, becomes effective. Mm-hmm. They can become effective immediately upon signature, or they spring into effect upon incapacity. The vast majority of our clients have the ones that spring into effect upon incapacity.
So up until that point, you can't write checks for that person.
Exactly.
when you craft these documents, are there any precautions that you take to have somebody else in the room? So, like you say, somebody could raise the issue of incapacity. But, like, sometimes you go to the doctor, now there's somebody else in that room. other than yourself and the doc, it's probably somebody on the doc staff, so that they could say, well, this person was there, this just wasn't me doing this. Or are there any precautionary language? I'm not asking for the language, but is that sometimes a good idea if you know the person, like you say, is sometimes tuned in and sometimes tuned out?
Yes. I won't get into the boring legal strategy with that exactly. Generally, we don't have somebody else in. We have the two witnesses that are just there when somebody's signing to say, yes, this is the person signing. Yes, if somebody has a capacity issue, we might have another attorney in, or we might have them get a mini medical evaluation from a doctor. Not always. It just depends. Each different attorneys will do different things.
Okay. Years ago, there was this show called The Millionaire. My father told me about this show, of course.
Right, of course.
And you know, it was the idea that some things are just for the wealthy. So over the years, when I heard will, it's just for somebody with a lot of money, because my folks went down to at that point the office supply store, and they had, you know, the I love you will. Yeah, here, you get everything if I go, and I get everything if you go. But it's not just for the wealthy, is it?
No, you know, but I do get that, particularly from my friends, or, you know, people who are mid-career or younger adults. They think, I don't need to bother. Even I had somebody come up to me the other day who was 60, in her late 60s, and she thought, I don't have much. It doesn't really matter. But even if you're not wealthy, you have an estate and you need a plan. Again, I go back to it's not about the pennies you have in your pocket. If you're a federal employee, you might have money in a TSP, or if you're a CSRS employee, you know, the lump sum that you have is part of CSRS. Fegley, you might have life insurance, 401k plans from other things, your house. Even if it's just your pet, your pet Fluffy and the stuff that you have in your home. The thing is that you do have an estate, and you should have a plan. It makes things so much easier for loved ones just to know, like, okay, they wanted not the sofa, maybe. They wanted the jewelry to go to you know, Aunt Thelma and, you know, something else. And it makes things a lot easier and much more orderly process after you pass away.
All righty. I bet there are some folks out there listening that have questions. So please give us a call. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And if you're listening, remember, we're doing this at 10:22 a.m. Monday, July 19th, 2010. We go off at 10:58, so don't call after that. However, you can email us, and I don't want to throw too many emails, and we're going to talk about how to get in touch with you, Ann, as well, in just a minute. But, you know, the 202-465-3080 number will do you good. Pick Ann's brains, Tammy's. Stay away from mine.
That's right.
All righty. We talked about people that we might name to be the executor or the administrator of our estate. And well, didn't we talk about the trustee or something?
Not yet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe
let's talk about
ahead.
That.
Let's talk about that. Yes, you're right. See, that's why the females are zeroed in. And
right.
The just kind of
that's what Bob
around.
Was like. All I don't
right,
know. So. I want to do this show.
All righty. So if we're looking for somebody to take over for our affairs, if you will, sometimes you say, yeah, I'll do my friend Lucy. This is you all talking. Should we just pick Lucy, or should we figure, does Lucy have the ability to stand up to charges? Not charges, criminal charges, right. But, you know, people will say, no, they were incapacitated. They didn't know what they were doing. Or to put up with the kids, if the kids say, no, I want a Corvette, I don't want college.
So how do you choose the person
how do you
that's
choose
going to
them
be?
And, you know, if you're choosing them as well, you'd like to do somebody you know.
So are
we
talking about the executor of your will?
Both. Yeah.
Both. Well, let's explain what that is first, because still like all these, I know all the benefits terms, but, you know, I think a lot of us are like me, where I'm just not real familiar with the terminology used in estate planning. So what is an executor?
So an executor, and by the way, in some states, including the ones out here, it's called a personal representative. But basically, an executor is somebody that you appoint who will, for a will, they're going to file your original will with the court. They're basically going to collect your assets for everything from, you know, up for probate property. And they'll collect your probate property, like the stuff you have in your house, your bank accounts, things that are in your own name, everything that is your in your own name, not including, you know, we'll get to in a moment what non-probate property mm-hmm. is. And you know that from the benefits. A lot mm-hmm. of benefits are non-probate property. But they'll collect your assets together. They're going to get somebody to appraise them. Like I said, the furniture in your house, that gets appraised. And then they'll see if there's any last bills that need to be paid. And they'll evaluate that, whether they pay them or they won't pay them. And then they will distribute their assets. And this is a court-run process, but they'll distribute your assets according to what you say in your will. And that's basically what the executor does. And I make it sound very simple. But if anybody out there, if there's anybody out there has served as an executor, it's not always the easiest thing.
And I've heard it can go in the court system for years. In some cases, depending on complexity or
it depends on the
who's
state.
Contesting it.
Right. It depends mm-hmm. on the state, too. Now, certain states have a pretty straightforward probate process. Certain ones are more complex. For example, Virginia has more complex probate. It's a more complex probate state. It can take longer to get through. Maryland has something called modified administration. And other states, you know, have that as well, from what I gather. But basically, you should be able to get through probate. You have to wait for the credit, like I said, for bills to come in and everything else. But you sometimes have the family dynamic where, you know, if siblings argue, they feel like they're not mm-hmm. getting enough. They don't like how somebody's running the process. And it can complicate things, for sure.
So how would you choose the executive? Is it somebody who's got a financial head, or is it someone that's close to you, or someone?
That's a great question.
Or maybe even, could you have it be your attorney?
You can. It's usually a family member mm-hmm. or a close friend. We say that, you know, you don't need to be a financial genius or something like that to be an executor. You need to know, you need to have common sense and know to get help from an attorney if you're appointed as the executor. And you need to know that when you're appointing someone that they'll go ahead and do that. And even if it's paying for like an hour of an attorney's time just to get their advice about how to go through the process, it's well worth it. Or sometimes the attorney will help go, mm-hmm. you know, will help somebody go through that process. But you want to have someone who's generally trustworthy, who you think will probably get along with other family members. Now, sometimes you have to choose between people and maybe the siblings won't get along. In that case, you pick the person who's most level-headed, I think, mm-hmm. that, you know, will faithfully manage your estate.
I get questions from clients as an accountant and said, would you be the executor of the estate? And the answer is no. Not because I don't like the people, not because I don't like the family members. It's just I know there's going to be a battle. Maybe not mm-hmm. the battle royal, but there's going to be. And I don't like conflict. So it would need somebody that doesn't mind conflict as well.
Well, I guess it could be mm-hmm. a time-consuming job, too, if it's a complicated estate.
Yeah.
It can be. In a lot of states, the personal representative or the executor can get compensated for that. A lot of family members waive that. But on the other hand, we have plenty of clients. It takes hours, you know, sometimes to just get everything together. And they might bill at a small rate, but they do get compensated for that. And you're right. Sometimes people appoint attorneys. We don't often do it, but we do it sometimes.
And people get appointed, they don't know it. I had a friend that passed, and I was named to be the administrator and the whatever you call it, of the trust. And I could have said no, but it was a good friend years ago that kind of lost it. And so I said no. They had two children, one normal, one not. And I got sued four times by the not normal ones.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
I did.
Why don't you buy this type of stock? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Next thing I know, and
you're in the
I called
of
the person up
feud.
One day, and I said, listen, you can sue me every week for the rest of your life, but I don't think it'll last that long because
you're running money.
You run out of your money.
Exactly.
It stopped.
That's the thing people need to realize. I do want to discuss sort of what you said in general about appointing people, not telling them. And then also just so people know that personal representatives, executors, if you sue them, they can use the estate money to defend themselves. They're not paying out of their own pocket. So I hate to see this, but sometimes you see people argue over estates, and really they're just paying the attorneys the money, you mm-hmm. know, but it's being paid out of the estate where they're the beneficiary. So they should think about that.
Before they.
But on more to the point of to prevent conflicts, it's a good idea to always talk to the people beforehand to let that you're planning to appoint, whether it's the agent under the power of attorney, your agent and your healthcare directive, or your executor, to make sure that they're willing to do it. I know why people don't. I think it's just, particularly if you're, maybe you're not married, or, you know, you're picking a close friend or something like that, you almost feel like you know that there's a job to be done here, or you feel either uncomfortable talking about the topic or asking. You're afraid they'll say no, maybe. And then what are you going to do? So, but really, you do want to take the element of surprise out of it, so people can sort of, everyone knows in advance, plan ahead. I think it can also prevent some conflicts down the road.
Okay. Now, in particular, because this is a focus on women.
Yes.
We were talking in the proverbial green room before, and you brought up something. You know, you mentioned the 55, and both Tammy and I go, wow. But it's money. You know, you said, boy, look at all this money. Well, all this money's got to last them for a certain period of time. And if there are children, or if there's domestic partners, or the like, they probably need to be more aware of how it's going to be managed.
That's right. They do, because they often have the last say, too, on, like I said, where how much mouth goes to the family, charity, or tax planning. And by the way, if you're going to do some tax planning, we can talk about this later, you really need to do it in advance. But there is some planning you can do with gifting later on. But women do need to think about this. And one thing I would like to say for some couples is I find that they're underinsured, or they don't have a safety net of emergency funds in their estate.
I think a lot of women who don't work outside the home feel like they don't need life insurance. But I think,
right,
especially if you're raising a family, you probably need a lot of it.
Well, oftentimes people, you see this where the person who isn't, or maybe there's one life insurance policy out there. They think they don't insure the breadwinner.
Mm-hmm.
They think that person will always be able to make a living. It doesn't matter. And in this case, maybe we're talking, it isn't always true, but let's just say the breadwinner is the husband. And if the wife, the spouse dies, they also need life insurance, or need to think about that, because you need to think how your life would change if you have children, you're a single parent. Mm-hmm.
You need somebody to help with housekeeping, raising the children.
Exactly. You know, all that, you know, the wife taking care of the kids, mm-hmm. the daycare, the housekeeping. Maybe you want to be there for your children and you have to work less.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think about, like, maybe I am going to have a reduction in income. What do I want my life to be? Do I want to be able to make sure that my kids have enough money to go through college? That's the other thing. People are underinsured. They might get a couple hundred thousand in life insurance, but you're thinking, you know, I want my kids to be able to go to college. College is expensive. So you really want to think about having a good amount in a term policy, or if you're not into life insurance, really saving up pretty well each month to have a backup plan. For other couples too, and everybody should have some emergency funds in place, just some basic emergency funds. So if somebody passes away, they will have enough money just to live off of for a few months, or to pay for funeral, and funerals are surprisingly expensive. But to pay for that, mm-hmm. because if you have money that isn't for separate accounts, it could take a little bit of time just to get that money rolled over, mm-hmm. or if it's probate, to go through probate.
Yeah, so you want to have some emergency funds. What you're saying about is if one of the married couples passed away, but also if one of them lost their job. So I guess it's always a good idea to have that emergency cash fund.
And if you're single, that applies.
Neither extreme.
That applies too. If you're single, just their last, they're like with funeral expenses, for example. You know, you want to leave enough just to have people kind of work through mm-hmm. some of those last expenses for you.
I work sometimes on the other side. Not that I work for you all, females, but a client will come in and says, my attorney says I need this much in life insurance, or my financial planner, this is way too much. And I go, no, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you're going to leave somebody young behind, whether they go to Ivy League or whether they don't go to school. Mm-hmm. there's school, let alone taking care of your bride after all this is done, because they haven't been in the workplace and they can't replicate the income. Now, maybe, I'm not being sexist with this. Yeah. And they get mad at me. And I said, you know, you're young enough so that you can, I'm not a financial planner.
But the good thing is, though, as 10 years, 20 years, 30 years goes by, those needs for that insurance are going to change. They might need a ton of it right now when they're just starting a family, but then 20 years down the road, the kids hopefully will be educated and can make their own way in life at that point.
That's a good point, Tammy. And, you know, term policies are not that expensive. And you can also, if you have some problems getting insured, if you're a federal government employee, Fegley is a great option. But you can, you're right. You think about, you want more when you're younger. You think about what kind of income you make for you're anticipating that you'd be gone, you know, that somebody would have to take care of children or somebody else for a long period of time. And then as you get older, you can reduce those amounts.
Yeah. Are there such things called kids trusts?
Well, I use that as a simple term, but you know, it's just a trust that takes effect, you know, after death. But basically, just as important as trying to figure out who will raise your children, you need to think about, you know, equally important is who will manage the money you've left for your child. Often even with a young adult. And always in the case of the minor, you don't want to leave money directly to them. It's better to leave it in a trust, and you appoint a trustee to manage that money for the kids until you say, you can say whenever you want. You know, I have people whose kids' trusts go until age 40, 50, and I have other ones where they just go to 30. You know, it just depends on the
kids.
Or
it could be incrementally saying at age 30, I want them to get
exactly.
much. And at age 40, I want them to get this much.
Listen, most of the time what we do is maybe a certain percentage goes to them right after college or, you know, when they hit the age of 22. And if they blow through that money, then hopefully they'll realize the value of money at that point. And then maybe another percentage at age 25, another percentage at 30, the rest at 35. So you define, like, when you want the money to go to them. And sometimes, like I said, you know your kids and you're like, no way. They can have the money when they're 50.
That's not something you can do in a will, though. That would be in a trust.
Well, it's something that you can do in a will, but it's a trust within your will. You can have trust within your will. And by the way, an alternative to a will is a living trust. It's just another way to pass on assets. The difference is that living trust, you don't go through probate. But you can have trusts within your will or trusts within your trust for tax planning and for these sort of quote-unquote, you know, kids' trusts, where you basically are saying, I'm going to appoint a trustee and have them manage the money for my kids.
All right, we're going to take a short break here to absorb all this fine information, and then on the backside, we'll get back into it.
Great.
Wake up and drive in with Tom Temin and Amy Morris on The Federal Drive. It's your early line on the day ahead from your trusted advisors. Tom and Amy give you a full view of the issues. Find out what your colleagues in other agencies are up to and what policy and congressional developments mean to you. The Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Amy Morris. Weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now. Looking for usable news and information that helps you do your job? Tune into In Depth with Francis Rose every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Francis explores the relationship between agencies and Congress by taking you to the hearing rooms on Capitol Hill and asking questions of federal decision makers and experts. You'll get a firsthand look at how Congress affects your agency's personnel, funding, and oversight. In Depth also looks at the relationship between agencies and contractors, companies that do billions of dollars of business with the federal government, talk about the work they're doing for agencies, the work they're bidding on, and the work they didn't get. And In Depth will help you be a better manager. Francis talks to authors, scholars, and managerial experts about managing projects, managing your workforce, and managing yourself. In Depth with Francis Rose, every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to NITP's It's For Your Benefit. Now, we're also talking about It's Just Not a Will. the importance of estate planning for women. And who better to lead us in that is Ann Sullivan, attorney with the firm Handler & Veen, I should say associate, and Tammy Flanagan. I think the name precedes the reputation. And we're talking about a lot of nifty things, but Ann, all these things you've told us, how does one get in touch with you if they were to have a question or to say, you know, I just don't understand that?
Well, a great question. you can get in touch with me either by phone. Our law firm, our phone number is 301-961-6464. Again, that's 301-961-6464. Or you can always email me. It's ann@handlerlevine.com. I'll spell that out. I do have Ann with an E. So it's A-N-N-E at Handler, H-A-N-D-L-E-R, and then L-E-V-I-N-E.com.
I think I know those two people. Mm-hmm. What's the first one's name? Norm?
Norm and Mark.
and the other one is
various
Mark.
Characters.
I met Norm probably about 30 years ago. He did a business settlement. And he orchestrated, it wasn't complex, but there were just whack jobs at the table. And I said, this guy's really got it.
Yes.
And he spoke English, and he just was very... Yeah.
I'd say all three of you at the law firm are very easy to talk to, and I think people would be very comfortable bringing these kind of issues up with you. So I will give you that plug.
Oh, thank you.
I know all three of you as well.
Rich, I do know that about them, too. Yes.
Okay, I was taking my orders from the ladies at the break, and they said, Bob, we need to talk more about... What was it again, Tammy?
Trust. I think... A lot of people have questions about what's the difference between a will and a trust. You know, what purpose do those two documents serve in relationship to each other? Do you need both?
You don't need both. And I think that, let me put it to you. Let's talk about it first. Okay, so there's different types of trusts, like we talked about before, that you could have in your will or what's called a living trust. But I think you're asking what's the difference between maybe a living trust and a will.
Mm-hmm.
And gosh, you see news articles about this everywhere. Sometimes you read that you have to have a living trust. That's not true. You don't have to have one, but they are really good for some people.
Yeah, who are they appropriate for?
Okay.
I guess would be the question.
Both documents, whether you have a trust or a will, again, it's a way to transfer assets to somebody else after death. With living trust, you do not go through probate, and with a will, you do go through probate. The whole purpose of a living trust is to, for the most part, is to avoid probate. There's no tax savings in having a living trust, which is a common misperception. What was your question?
who would be a more appropriate candidate for a living trust
thank
versus
you.
Just a will?
Thank you. That's my train of thought there. Okay, so there's
maybe
basically...
Maybe go through your... Yes. Early stage, mid stage, late stage versus...
Well, it can apply to everybody. But basically, there's a couple of different situations where you really may want to look at a living trust rather than having a will. And by the way, there's always a backup will to your living trust. So when you say, do you have one or the other, note that if you have a living trust, you always have what's called a pour over or a backup will to that trust. One, if you have out-of-state real estate, you want to think about having a living trust. Reason, like, so if I own property, like, say, here in Maryland, but I also own property in Hawaii or North Carolina or wherever, you have to go through probate. Your loved ones will have to go through probate
in
two states. Mm. It's a pain. So you might want to think having a living trust. If you have a living trust, includes those properties, then you can avoid probate. If you are somebody... And I shouldn't mention my brother over here. I don't think he'd mind. But some people are very interested in privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Wills are public knowledge. If you're very into privacy and you really don't want people to see your will and see what goes where, living trust might be for you. If you have capacity issues, I had a client a little while back. He was a federal employee and a wonderful guy. He was single and in his mid-50s, and he had some health issues. He wanted to make things as easy as possible for his brothers to take over his assets while he was alive and then after he died. And living trust works a little bit better, I think, for anticipated capacity issues than maybe a power of attorney.
But I guess the other thing, too, mm-hmm. would be, because it sounds like, you know, if everything you're saying is, I want a living trust, but the one catch is, that costs more to prepare than just a simple will.
That's right. And that's what I think, that they're not right for everybody. You know, they do cost a little bit more to prepare up front. But the other part of it is you have to be the kind of person that will, you know, keep up. You've got to fund that trust. And the attorney can help you to some extent in that regard, like transferring your property to trust. You have to transfer everything except for maybe your car and a small bank account to that trust, to the name of the trust.
I've heard stories of people who set up a trust, go through all the process, and never put anything in it.
Oh, for Pete's sakes. We see that. We see that from other. We see unfunded
trusts. After someone
dies. It doesn't matter. You can create the trust, but you have to fund it. You actually have to transfer the property to the trust. And for young people or even mid-career or people who you've got to think this throughout time.
How many times things are going to change?
Exactly. And this doesn't just apply to mid-career. Like, if you're thinking about retirement, maybe you have one of these trusts and you have your primary home in it. But what if you retire and decide to buy a beach home, something like that? You need to fund the property because if you don't fund the trust, that property will go through probate.
So it has to be part of that.
Right.
That's a very good point, and you bring up a bad memory. It didn't end bad, but the individual set up within the will these trusts. And the individual was always doing something else other than at the moment. Mm-hmm. They never funded it. Mm-hmm. And the beneficiaries were different if the asset's been in the trust rather than in the will. And they were hot. And I just kind of said, listen, I think you need to talk to your attorney. This is why I'm out. You know, I was a traffic cop. I was not the facilitator. So outstanding point, because people just, I'll do that later.
Yep.
And then once later happens, it's too depressing to think about.
Yeah, I was going to bring up at the same time we're talking about wills and trusts, because with federal employees, we always want to maintain up-to-date beneficiary designations. And we've got them for, all federal employees have potentially four different beneficiary forms to file, one for government life insurance, one for TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan, one for their retirement system, SERS or FERS, and then one also while you're an employee for unpaid compensation, which I think could be the most important one, because that's who gets your last paycheck and your unused annual leave to pay the mortgage that month and to pay all the upfront bills. So would you put these documents, would you say on my beneficiary forms paid to the trust of Ann Sullivan, or would you just make those directly to the person you want the money to go to?
That's a good question. I'm glad it kind of bounces off Bob's point about seeing things that, want to make sure when an attorney should help you with this. If you go to an attorney to get a will done, power of attorney, healthcare directive, they should prepare your beneficiary forms. But you want to make sure that the main thing is make sure your beneficiary forms are current and they tie into your overall beneficiary plan. Well, just in the point of being current, look, we're all guilty of this. You start off as a federal employee or any other place, and you do these forms on day one, and you forget about them. You forget about them.
Two marriages and a divorce later, you still have your parents down.
I'm guilty of this. I was working, and I would do these seminars, and I realize I'm talking, and I'm like, what a hypocrite. Because I had worked at a place, and I love my brother and my cousin, but they were like the beneficiaries of my beneficiary forms, and I got married, and I had a child. So I just got the changed over. Yeah. Sorry to my brother and cousin.
But Tammy, you wrote an article on that, didn't you, in GovExec? Yeah.
Yeah, I like to keep that current, because I think we do tend to forget to keep those up to date, or where are the forms?
Do you have copies? Right.
Yeah, and
right.
So many people didn't save their employee copy. They're like, where do I find my original? I'm like, well, it should be at home in that 3-ring binder where you've kept all your employee copies, but a lot of people didn't maintain them.
But you can go online pretty easily and, go into OPM's website and fill them out, which will tie into the
second. You get the blank forms.
Tammy's article, if you do want to look at it, it's on our website, NITPINC.com, left-hand side. It says Tammy's GovExec articles. Click on.
It was one of the last few that probably 3 weeks ago or so.
Then you can look at the archives, and if you really have some time to spend, which you should, reading in the summer, it goes back close to 5 years.
That's right.
Anyway, but you could zero in on that. And what's nice about Tammy's articles, she'll mention a form, but she'll have a hyperlink to it, and you just click on, and there it is.
That's
perfect.
Right.
Perfect. So that's like the important point is keeping it current, because, while certain for example, your pension, you can't divest your spouse of your pension unless they sign and say, okay, you can do that. But other forms do not discuss that. And if you're not careful, if they're out of date, like I said, if you get married or divorced or something like that, you do not want to have some old boyfriend, some old girlfriend, some ex-spouse on your form where you didn't intend that to be.
And it happens.
Then it does happen sometimes, and you're out of luck. So really, make sure they're current. And how do you tie them into your overall plan? Well, this is what you're talking about. Do I send this to my trust? Where do I put these benefits to? If you have a living trust or a will, generally, you know, this is non-probate property. I want to be clear here. Your life insurance, retirement benefits, those type of assets, they go by contract. They go by what's on that form. And you can just leave them, avoid probate, and just leave them directly to the person. Mm-hmm. Now, on the point of can you tie them into a trust, yes. And certain times we do that in our practice. Now, some of this, you know, it's complicated, so you want to go into, you know, and see whether it fits for you. But a good example of this is, say you've got vaguely life insurance or just a life insurance policy and you've got children, young adults. Maybe you want to leave it directly to a spouse as the primary beneficiary, but the contingent, we see this all the time, you do not want to leave as contingent beneficiaries the kids directly. Unless you know for sure that they will be able to handle it. Right. Mm-hmm. If they can't handle the money or if you're worried about that, you can tie it into that, what we call that quote, the kids trust in your will. Or if you have tax planning, sometimes there's something called a bypass trust or a credit shelter trust that you put in your will and you can tie in, you know, as a beneficiary, the trust under your will for that.
All right. Let's take a quick zig towards tax planning. I don't mean to be gross with this, but for tax purposes, 2010 was the year to pass if you had had a large estate, because there is no estate tax at the federal level. But
yeah, consider George Steinbrenner's
congratulations to Steinbrenner's. Not congratulations, but yes, I mean, it's a year where there's no federal estate taxes.
But and we don't know what's going to happen in 2011. You did mention something before we went on air that was very interesting. But again, if we shift the spotlight back to the female, say there was a marriage and then the female survived, she may have received life insurance to care for the children and whatnot. Now, all of a sudden, she's got an estate tax issue.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what a lot of people get confused about, because we say, oh, life insurance is not subject to income tax, which is true. But we forget about the fact that we may carry so much life insurance that it could push us into an estate planning issue, which is different than income tax, which I always used to be confused about.
Well, it gets added to the top, like you say, Tammy. I mean, somebody may have a home. They may not have a home. They have a pinball machine. No, that's a male. or they have nice art and furniture.
Jewelry.
Female.
Lots of jewelry.
Lots of jewelry and whatnot. And all that. And you mentioned that. That all gets valued.
Yes.
And so if you were to add that on top of whatever this chunk of money got, mid-career, late mid-career, there's probably more need for insurance. All of a sudden,
and your retirement.
And states don't follow the federal. Federal is generally more generous. With regards to the cap.
Because you have estate planning, and you have federal estate planning, which can be two different taxes.
That's right. There's it used to be that there was a revenue sharing agreement between the feds and the state, but there's on the federal level, you know, and there is. Last week there were two senators, I believe, Senator Lincoln and Kyle. A Republican and a Democrat that have attached to a small business bill, a new estate tax, which would be everyone would be able to pass on $5 million to somebody else tax free. And by the way, you can pass anything you want to your spouse. It's not taxed at the first death; it's taxed at the second death. But $5 million, and it would be at a lower percentage, 35% tax rate. But who knows if that will pass? And next year, it's frightening what it would look like if nothing passes. It looks like what it was many years ago, which is we only could pass on $1 million to somebody else. And then after that, the government, the feds would tax 55% on the dollar. And people remember, it is life insurance, retirement accounts, and everything. So so I don't know. People will have to look out to see what's going to happen in the fall.
I could wipe out half of the estate over $1 million, or more than half, really.
Yeah, so people really say $1 million, but I mean, again, in an urban area that might, in a rural area.
Before the decline of the housing market, it could have been more people.
Right. Well, you think it is a lot of money, but really, you've got to add up everything you have. You can't think of it in terms of what you walk around with. It's everything that will pass. And even with younger couples that have those term life insurance policies, that could very easily add up past then. So you don't want to lose a lot of that money to state taxes. And there's again, money on people have to look at it on the state level too. A lot of states, or a fair number of them, and it's growing because of the economy, of states have their own separate estate tax. For example, Maryland and the District of Columbia for any amounts over $1 million, they tax. It's at a much lower rate, but it's 16%. Mm-hmm. So for couples that do have over $1 million, you do want to talk, you'd want to maybe talk to an attorney to see what planning you could do to help minimize that tax, and make sure you have to do it in advance. You have to plan, do tax planning. You can't do it after death. You have to do it in advance in your will.
And you mentioned an out-of-state asset. You know, everyone would like to have a beach house, but maybe some people have Aunt Nellie's farm in Nebraska.
Right.
That's what do you call it? Probate?
Well, for real estate, it's probate. But in terms of taxes, say, and by the way, Virginia does not have a state estate tax. Delaware, surprisingly, now has one. We never thought that they would. But so just in the way of taxes, if you have Aunt Nellie who has a farm that's worth a lot out in Nebraska, even though that's not Maryland property, Maryland will add Aunt Nellie's farm into into your estate for calculating how much it's going to tax you. That's surprising to people because they think, oh, it's out of state. It doesn't matter. Maryland will take that into consideration.
Wow.
Okay, and just a quickie, and we're coming to the end. Mm-hmm. Gifting. I get clients that call up and said, you know, my attorney told me that, you know, I should have a gifting program.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, yes, it should all begin and end with me. But I'm just kidding. The point being is, it isn't just you're giving people money and you're somehow going to get an income tax deduction. It will reduce your estate. Is that a fair assumption in 30 seconds?
I know we're kind of running out of time here. So I'll just say that a lot of baby boomers are interested in making gifts, seeing what those look like, you know, where their money goes when they're still alive. Just an important point. There's some things that you two can do for gifting to avoid a gift tax. The best ways to do that is you can give $13,000 to anyone you want each year annually. It's an annual gift tax exclusion. You can give double for spouses. That's a great way. If you're interested in paying for grandchildren's education, you can pay money directly for college tuition, high school, elementary school tuition, and health care. You can also pay directly for health care expenses. These are some great ways to sort of help people during your life.
Well, Ann, thanks for giving us so much great information today.
Thank you.
And Tammy, final comment?
I would just say follow up on some of the things we've talked about, especially updating beneficiary forms, since that's my area.
That's right.
All righty, and thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week on the 26th at 10:05 a.m.
Thanks,
Have
Tom.
A good week. Bye-bye.
Bye, Tammy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM-HD2 Manassas, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM-HD2 Manassas.
Looking for usable news and information that helps you do your job? Tune into In Depth with Francis Rose every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Francis explores the relationship between agencies and Congress by taking you to the hearing rooms on Capitol Hill and asking questions of federal decision makers and experts. You'll get a firsthand look at how Congress affects your agency's personnel, funding, and oversight. In Depth also looks at the relationship between agencies and contractors, companies that do billions of dollars of business with the federal government talk about the work they're doing for agencies, the work they're bidding on, and the work they didn't get. And In Depth will help you be a better manager. Francis talks to authors, scholars, and managerial experts about managing projects, managing your workforce, and managing yourself. In Depth with Francis Rose, every weekday afternoon from 1 to 3 on Federal